What happens when you discover your child has committed an unthinkable act of violence? On April 20, 1999, Sue Colbold received a call from her husband. There's been a shooting at Columbine High School. As she drove home, her mind cycled through every scenario except the truth that her son Dylan was one of the gunmen. By nightfall, police confirmed Dylan was dead. In that moment, she joined the ranks of parents who lost children that day, but with an unbearable difference. Her son wasn't just a victim, he was one of the perpetrators. For hours, she and her husband Tom paced their driveway like frightened animals, while helicopters circled overhead and armed officers searched their home for explosives. Sue's prayers shifted from hoping for Dylan's safety to praying for his death if he was truly harming others. Just a month earlier, she had told a friend her life had never been more satisfying: a loving marriage, a thriving older son, and Dylan back on track with college acceptances arriving. Within 24 hours, she became the mother of a hate-crazed gunman responsible for the worst school shooting in history. Sue describes Dylan as the sunshine boy, a sensitive child who excelled academically and seemed to navigate life with ease. He maintained close friendships, worked at Blackjack Pizza, and handled sound engineering for school theater productions. Baseball had been central to his childhood, connecting him across generations. When painful elbow inflammation prevented him from making the high school team, it represented a greater loss than his parents realized. By junior high, Dylan became increasingly self-conscious, telling his mother it wasn't cool to be smart. While he continued to excel academically, Sue and Tom focused more attention on their older son, Byron, who was struggling with typical teenage challenges. Dylan maintained his pattern of self-reliance and doing what was expected. What haunts Sue most is the ordinariness of their lives. Dylan wasn't a troubled child they worried over. Everything seemed to come easily to him. She wishes she had known it was possible for everything to seem fine when it wasn't. Dylan's journals revealed depression, isolation, and suicidal thoughts beginning 2 years before Columbine. Despite having friends, he felt he didn't belong. Experts found persistent themes of depression, suicidality, and alienation, possibly major depression with transient psychotic episodes. 9 out of 10 school shooters suffer from depression and suicidal thoughts. Reading about youth suicide prevention gave Sue a revelation. Dylan had gone to the school to die. In America, someone dies by suicide every 13 minutes. It's the third leading cause of death among people aged 10 to 14, and second among those 15 to 34. Though Dylan showed outward signals, Sue and Tom couldn't decode them. A month before the shootings, she found him staring blankly with what she now recognizes as a thousand-yard stare, a warning sign for imminent suicide. If they had understood those signs, Sue believes they could have prevented Columbine. Dylan's journals revealed the fatal dynamic with Eric Harris. When Dylan's close friends began dating in summer 1997, he felt betrayed and spent more time with Eric. Though Dylan had written about suicide for nearly 2 years, homicidal thoughts only appeared that fall. Even while planning, Dylan's writings show he believed he'd die by his own hand before execution day. Once Dylan told Sue, "Eric's crazy," but she simply responded that he'd meet difficult people throughout life. She had no conception of the danger. Eric's journals overflowed with sadistic images and destruction fantasies, markedly different from Dylan's focus on loneliness and longing for love. Many experts believe Eric displayed psychopathic traits. Research shows 25% of adolescent school shooters participate in pairs, typically one psychopath and one suggestible, depressed partner. When Eric tried recruiting other boys, they refused, but Dylan didn't. Nearly half of rampage shooters die by suicide during attacks, displaying what experts call life indifference. Dylan took comfort in death's idea, but lacked capability for suicide alone. Planning the rampage with Eric became how Dylan rehearsed his own death. Sue created a parallel timeline using both journals to track Dylan's final days. Senior year brought seemingly positive developments: early termination from diversion, college acceptances in February. When Sue asked if he wanted to stay local, Dylan firmly replied, "I definitely want to go away." Looking back, she believes he meant death. At parent-teacher conferences, Dylan's English teacher mentioned a disturbing paper with dark themes about a man in black killing popular kids at school. Sue asked to see it, but forgot by nighttime. She finally read it a year after his death. 2 weeks before the massacre, Sue spontaneously hugged Dylan in the hallway, telling him she loved him. He barely touched her back. She held his face and repeated her words. He looked down, embarrassed, and whispered thanks. 4 days before the tragedy, Tom and Dylan studied a University of Arizona map together. The next morning, Dylan rushed out early. "Dill," she called into darkness. "Bye," was all he said. On Valentine's Day 2001, Sue was diagnosed with breast cancer. Surviving it revealed a profound truth. She wanted to live. Though Tom often wished Dylan had killed them too, Sue realized her life was a gift she needed to honor. In the second year after Dylan's death, Sue found community through the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Colorado. Terrified of judgment, she walked into her first meeting. 10 minutes later, she sat with 5 other mothers who'd lost children to suicide, tying raffia bows onto flower pots. There was nothing but love and compassion. The chance to grieve for Dylan as her son, regardless of his final actions, was invaluable. After identifying herself as a suicide loss survivor, Sue became deeply involved in initiatives to prevent suicide and violence. This work became her calling, a path out of darkness. When tragedies like Columbine happen, everyone asks why. Sue believes the better question is how. Only someone in distress with vulnerability to suicide sees death as logical. Asking how frames self-destructive behavior as a process that can be interrupted. Violence can be prevented through threat assessment, not profiling. Prevention doesn't require prediction. Effective schools use tiered systems, universal access to brain health screenings, conflict resolution, and suicide prevention, targeted support for struggling students, and intensive intervention for high-risk cases. We must acknowledge the danger of accessible, lethal firearms during vulnerable moments. Brain health is health. We all have the capacity to suffer. We teach children dental care and financial responsibility. Why not brain health monitoring? Sue's greatest regret is not teaching Dylan this. Daily, she carries overwhelming guilt for failing him and for the destruction he caused. She thinks constantly about the victims, their final terror, everyone who loved them. She wishes she had known, had stopped him, but she can't go back. Depression and brain disorders don't eliminate someone's moral compass, yet these life-threatening diseases can impair judgment and distort reality. When we better help people before crisis, everyone becomes safer.